following program is intended for mature audiences.
Get off the babysitter. Put on your pants. Come out with your hands up.
No logic, no reason, no explanation.
You hear about Trump?
Just a prolonged nightmare.
Be careful, son, I can sue you.
Which fear, loneliness, and the unexplainable walk hand in hand through the shadows. Because this is the Twilight Zone.
Bing, bing, bong, bing, bing, bong.
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tom Savino from Burbank, California, Lion's Den Studios here in Burbank, California. Tonight, we take a look at fascism that has taken root in America. In the present may be dark, the future may be all bright. We're going to be taking a look at Madeleine Albright and what she has to offer on this subject. Please stay tuned.
Nazis. And for no other reason, I was picked up and separated from my family, who was exterminated in Auschwitz. And I am a survivor of Auschwitz and Dachau. I spent 5.5 years in concentration camp. For one reason and one reason only. Because we picked on people. And you as the sheriff, who we elected as sheriff of this county. We did not elect you as the sheriff of Washington, D.C. It's about time you serve the people here. And when this gentleman stands up there and he says he doesn't go after any people, he should read today's B. Because of today's me, the Supreme Court Justice of State of California objected to ICE coming in and taking people away from the courts. Don't tell me that this is a lie. You stand up here, Mr. Jones, don't forget, history is not on your side. That man is 90 years old. Jewish, I'm guessing?
What is wrong with you?
I suspect this Holocaust survivor is in favor of abolishing ICE. I am, although in this case, even if nothing is done, eventually ICE will melt.
I don't think that's funny.
More importantly, the fascism that created ICE, or at least this Nazi-like iteration of King Khan's ICE, cruel, inhuman, and brutal family separating ICE, is unfortunately alive and well, and forever frozen and solid, unless we the people apply the heat to it. This fascism is not going to melt. It takes a nuclear heat of massive resistance. I fear, frankly, that it has rooted here in the United States too deeply already, and it'll take more than mouse-click activism to eradicate. Let me be clear here. I am not advocating violence, but I'm suggesting this Russian-planted and watered with Trump urine...
Yeah, that's a good one.
...version of fascism here, now in the United States and Europe will require, if history does in fact repeat itself, guns, ammo, and bloodshed with lives lost.
Yeah.
Oh, you betcha, yeah.
Yeah.
What, you ask? Lives lost? Lives are most certainly being lost right now at the cold, deadly hands of ice. Children, infants, being purposely separated from their mothers and fathers. In the name of what? In the name of security? And why?
Well, I want to know about this.
Why? To fill the prison cells of corporately owned prisons and jails filled with terrorized refugees and the infants of those refugees as handsome payment for those corporations' support, both financial and civil, for our sad clown president. Former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was herself a terrorized refugee from Czechoslovakia. Her parents and she fled that nation in 1938 when Hitler and his stormtroopers invaded. Like the 90-year-old man at the beginning of this Savino Veritas episode, she and her family were Jewish. She, like the children and infants that Trump now imprisons and purposely separates from their parents, was a child then. Imagine if she had been jailed and separated from her parents, who all, thankfully, eventually made it safely and securely here in the United States of America. Madeleine Albright's book, Fascism, A Warning, was released in April, experiencing a better fate than infants and child refugees who are still not released and may never be reunited with their parents. I'll read the cover flaps of the book.
Fascism.
A governmental system led by a dictator having complete power.
Bing, bing, bong.
Forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism. Regimenting all industry, commerce, etc., and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism and often racism.
Fascism, a warning. A personal and urgent examination of fascism in the 20th century and how its legacy shapes today's world, written by one of America's most admired public servants, the first woman to serve as United States Secretary of State. A fascist, observes Madeleine Albright, is someone who claims to speak for a whole nation or group, is utterly unconcerned with the rights of others, and is willing to use violence and whatever other means are necessary to achieve the goals he or she might have. The 20th century was defined by the clash between democracy and fascism, a struggle that created uncertainty about the survival of human freedom and left millions of innocent people dead. Given the horrors of that experience, one might expect the world to reject the spiritual successors to Hitler and Mussolini should they arise in our era. In Fascism, A Warning, Madeleine Albright draws on her own experiences as a child in war-torn Europe and her distinguished career as a diplomat to question that very assumption. Fascism, as Albright shows, not only endured through the course of the 20th century, but now presents a more virulent threat to international peace and justice than at any time since the end of World War II. The momentum toward democracy that swept the world when the Berlin Wall fell has gone into reverse. The United States, which has historically championed the free world, is led by a president who exacerbates popular division and heaps scorn on democratic institutions.
Be careful, son, I can sue you.
In many countries, economic, technological, and cultural factors are weakening the political center and empowering the extremes of right and left. Contemporary leaders such as Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un are employing many of the same tactics used by fascists in the 1920s and 30s. Fascism, A Warning is a book for our times that is relevant to all times, written with wisdom by someone who has not only studied history, but helped to shape it. This call to arms teaches us the lessons we must understand and the questions we must answer if we are to save ourselves from repeating the tragic errors of the past. And in case you don't know it, or if you're old like me and forget things, Madeleine Albright served as America's 64th Secretary of State from 1997 to 2001. Her distinguished career also includes positions at the White House, on Capitol Hill, and a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. She's a resident of Washington, D.C. and Virginia. Also, as a non-native United States citizen, she, as I've already said, was a refugee. She held, and I believe she may be the only person in the history of the United States to hold the highest office allowed by the Constitution for a person who is not a native-born United States citizen. I'm going to read you the beginning of Chapter 1, A Doctrine of Anger and Fear. On the day fascists first altered the direction of my life.
Fascism.
A governmental system led by a dictator having complete power.
Bing, bing, bong.
Forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism, regimenting all industry, commerce, etc., and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism and often racism.
I had barely mastered the art of walking. The date was March 15, 1939. Battalions of German stormtroopers invaded my native Czechoslovakia, escorted Hitler to Prague Castle, and pushed Europe to the threshold of a Second World War. After 10 days in hiding, my parents and I escaped to London. There we joined exiles from all across Europe in aiding the Allied war effort for the ordeal to end. When after 6 grueling years the Nazis surrendered, we returned home with high hopes, eager to build a new life in a free land. My father continued his career in the Czechoslovak Foreign Service, and for a brief time, all was well. Then in 1948, our country fell under the control of communists. Democracy was shut down, and once more my family was driven into exile. That Armistice Day, we arrived in the United States, where, under the watchful eyes of the Statue of Liberty, we were welcomed as refugees.
Harbors open their arms to the young searching foreigners. To the heart of America, people were waiting in line for a place by the river. It was a time when strangers were welcome here. Music would play, they tell me the days were sweet and clear. with his hopes and his heart set on miracles. Come to marry his fortune with a handful of promises. To finally close the door, they don't want him anymore. There isn't any more to go. He once heard a legend that spoke of a mystical, magical land called America. There was a time when strangers were welcome here. Music would play, they tell me the days were sweet and clear. It was a sweeter
us than to make my life and those of my sister Kathy and brother John seem as normal as possible. My parents did not tell us what we would learn only decades later, that three of our grandparents and numerous aunts, uncles, and cousins were among the millions of Jews who had died in the ultimate act of fascism, the Holocaust. I was 11 when I came to the United States with no goal more ambitious than to become a typical American teenager. I ditched my European accent, read stacks of comic books, glued my ear to a transistor radio, and became stuck on bubblegum. I did everything I could to fit in, but I could not escape knowing that in our times, even decisions made far away could spell the difference between death and life. On entering high school, I started an international affairs club, named myself president, and provoked discussions about everything from Titoism to Gandhi's concept of satyagraha. The force which is born of truth and love. My parents cherished the freedoms we found in our adopted country. My father, who quickly established himself as a professor at the University of Denver, wrote books about the perils of tyranny and worried that Americans were so accustomed to liberty, so, quote, very, very free, end quote, he wrote, that they might take democracy for granted. After I began a family of my own, my mother called each 4th of July to confirm that her grandchildren were singing patriotic songs and had been to the parade. There's a tendency among many in the United States to romanticize the years just after World War II, to imagine a time of sky-blue innocence when everyone agreed that America was great and each family had a reliable breadwinner, the latest appliances, children who were above average, and a rosy outlook on life. In fact, the Cold War was a period of unceasing anxiety in which the lingering shadow of fascism was darkened by another kind of cloud. In my teenage years, due to atomic tests, the radioactive element strontium-90 was found in babies' teeth at 50 times the natural level. Virtually every town had a civil defense warden urging the construction of backyard fallout shelters stocked with canned vegetables. Children in big cities were issued metal tags embossed with their names for identification should the worst happen. Growing older, I followed in my father's footsteps and became a professor. Among my specialties was Eastern Europe, where countries were dismissed as satellites orbiting a totalitarian sun, and where it was widely thought that nothing interesting ever happened and nothing of importance would ever change. Marx's dream of the workers' paradise had denigrated into an Orwellian nightmare. Conformity was the highest good. Informants kept watch on every block. Whole countries lived behind barbed wire, and governments insisted that down was up and black was white. Then when change did come, it was with a velocity that amazed. In June 1989, the decade-old demands of dock workers and the inspiration of a pope brought democratic governance to Poland. That October, Hungary became a democratic republic, and in early November, the Berlin Wall was breached. In those miraculous days, our televisions brought news each morning of what had long seemed impossible. I can still picture the decisive moments of my native Czechoslovakia's Velvet Revolution, so called because it was secured without the widespread cracking of heads and gunfire. The time was a frosty afternoon in late November. In Prague's historic Wenceslas Square, a crowd of 300,000 joyously rattled keys to emulate bells tolling the end of the communist rule. On a balcony overlooking the throng stood Václav Havel, a valiant playwright who 6 months earlier had been a prisoner of conscience, and 5 weeks later would be sworn in as president of a free Czechoslovakia. In that instant, I was among the many who felt that democracy had aced its severest test. The once mighty USSR, made fragile by economic weakness and ideological weariness, shattered like a dropped vase on a stone floor.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Liberating Ukraine, the Caucasus, the Baltics, and Central Asia. The nuclear arms race subsided without blowing any of us to bits. In the East, South Korea, the Philippines, and Indonesia cast off longtime dictators. In the West, Latin America's military rulers made way for elected presidents. In Africa, the freeing of Nelson Mandela, another prisoner who became president, engendered hopes of a regional renaissance. Around the globe, countries meriting the label democracy expanded from 35 to more than 100. In January of 1991, George H.W. Bush told Congress that, quote, "The end of the Cold War has been a victory for all humanity, and America's leadership was instrumental in making it possible," end quote. Across the Atlantic, Havel added, quote, "Europe is attempting to create a historical new kind of order through the process of unification, a Europe in which no one more powerful will be able to suppress anyone less powerful, in which it will no longer be possible to settle disputes with force," end quote. Today, more than a quarter century later, we must ask what has happened to that uplifting vision. Why does it seem to be fading instead of becoming more clear? Why, per Freedom House, is democracy now, quote, "under assault and in retreat," end quote? Why are many people in positions of power seeking to undermine public confidence in elections, the courts, the media, and on the fundamental question of Earth's future, science?
I'm going to have to science the shit out of this.
Why have such dangerous splits been allowed to develop between rich and poor, urban and rural, those with a higher education and those without? Why has the United States at least temporarily abdicated its leadership in world affairs? And why, this far into the 21st century, are we once again talking about fascism? This is Tom Savino with Savino Veritas from Burbank, California. We are, as we often are, talking about fascism.
Fascism.
A governmental system led by a dictator having complete power.
Bing, bing, bong.
Forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism, regimenting all industry, commerce, etc. and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism and often racism.
The fascism that has taken root here. I totally recommend reading Madeleine Albright's book because it not only tells us what happened, what is happening, but how we can combat the spread of fascism, how we could pull up from the roots that have already been implanted by Russian President Putin, how we could pull those roots up. And once again, hopefully, create a stable and secure democratic republic here in the United States and democracy throughout the world. And you may be saying, well, this is over the top here. This is not happening here. It is happening here. This government is saying black is white and white is black, and too many people are believing it. Too many people are believing it. Maybe over a third of people in the United States of America, adults, maybe over a third of the adults in the United States of America are believing when the government says this is black when it's white, and this is white when it's black. Orwellian nightmare right here in the United States. To illustrate this, here is a fact, not an alternative fact, a fact. A few days ago, in the Congress, in the House of Representatives of the United States of America, a bill was introduced called the Anti-Antifa Bill. Basically, it would call for a 15-year prison sentence for anyone arrested protesting fascism. It would call for a 15-year prison sentence for anyone protesting who was arrested protesting against fascism if that person wore a mask.
Fascism.
A governmental system led by a dictator having complete power.
Bing, bing, bong.
Forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism, regimenting all industry, commerce, etc., and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism and often racism.
Do you hear about Trump?
We're going to hear now from the man in charge of implementing President Trump's immigration enforcement agenda. It's a busy time at Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Deportations far from the border increased 25% in the last year. Homeland Security wants money to increase the number of beds in immigration detention centers. And this comes as Congress struggles to rework immigration policy before another government shutdown deadline. Thomas Homan is the acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He has worked in immigration enforcement for more than 30 years. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Congress is working right now on what should happen to DACA recipients, people who were brought to the U.S. as young children. President Trump floated a path to citizenship when he put out a new framework for immigration legislation last night. The right wing of his party has balked at that. And in the meantime, thousands of DACA recipients have already lost their coverage. So I want to ask you whether those people are at risk of being deported today.
Well, as a law enforcement agency, we have to prioritize what we do. And if you look at the FY17 numbers we rolled out, it clearly shows that 89% of everybody we arrested, you know, had some sort of criminal history. So for those DACA recipients, I mean, if they're in the country illegally, they can be arrested. However, we do prioritize our work. So if a DACA recipient lost his status and went and committed a crime, of course, they would rise on a list of priorities. But 92% of everybody we arrested fell into three buckets. Either they're a criminal, or they're a fugitive, or they're reentry. If the message we want to continue to send to the world is, you can violate the laws of this country, come here, we use billions of dollars a year to enforce immigration law and give you due process that you deserve, and a judge makes a decision, you'll be removed from the country. But if you want to have a U.S. citizen child by virtue that you give birth to a child in this country, that now you're immune from the criminal justice system, now you're immune from enforcement, now you've virtually get amnesty, then you're never going to solve the illegal immigration crisis. We got to send a clear message.
I've spoken to people whose DACA coverage has lapsed, who are afraid that if they attend a march or grant an interview with their name, they will be deported. Now, I know you've said those people are not priorities, but are you saying that if they don't have any criminal run-ins, they won't be deported even if they speak out publicly and advocate and give interviews and march?
Look, there's first of all, again, we prioritize what we do. Criminals and public safety threats come first. But for those people that are, you know, are found to be in the country illegally, they're not off the table. They can be arrested. But we do it in a prioritized manner.
You're not giving a blanket reassurance that DACA recipients will be okay if their coverage has expired. You're saying they're not a priority, but you're not saying 100% you're going to be fine.
If we encounter them during a targeted enforcement operation, like we're out looking for a criminal alien, and we run into somebody that has lost their DACA status, we will take action, put them in front of an immigration judge, and let the immigration judge make that determination. But we will not turn the blind eye to somebody that we find during our enforcement operations in the country illegally.
I'd like to ask you about another detail in the White House's framework for immigration legislation. They've called for $25 billion to build a border wall system. And that word system is broad. So I wonder what you would most like to see that money spent on.
Well, first of all, I do support a wall. I've been doing this work for 34 years. I did start out on the Border Patrol, and I've been in places where there wasn't a wall, and I've been in places where there was a wall.
But the question is, does wall mean brick and mortar, or does wall mean drones and electronic surveillance and more border agents and all kinds of other things?
It's a combination, right? There's going to be places, it's going to be a wall. It's going to be places where it's going to be electronics. Like, you can't put a wall in the middle of Rio Grande. So I'm just speaking from my own experience. Every place they have built a wall or a barrier, it has worked. 100% of the time, illegal migration has decreased wherever there's a barrier put.
Do you think $25 billion is the right number? Democrats have said it's too high. Do you know where the number came from? Is it something you've been asking for specifically?
No, and I haven't been involved with the finance of the wall, how much the wall costs. And I, you know, my personal opinion is, what's too much? I mean, what cost you put on public safety and national security? I think we're a sovereign country. We have a right to protect this nation. But as far as the cost of the wall and where they came up with that $25 billion, I wouldn't know that. You have to get that from CBP.
Customs and Border Protection, yeah. President Trump has said he would like to get illegal border crossings down to zero. Meanwhile, there are an estimated 11 million people already in the country illegally. And I wonder whether you have a target number for what you would like that population to get to from the current 11 million figure.
There is no target number. I think, again, I think we got to concentrate on finding those that are either a national security threat or a public safety threat first, then we need to work our way back down, right? We need to look at for the fugitives, those that have their due process, refuse to leave the United States. But I don't think there's any magic number. I think if we can take the magnets away and really address the underlying reasons for illegal immigration, and we take the magnets away, like, you know, employment, make it hard to get a job. That's one of the reasons they come.
You mean
to
the reasons
country.
People come, the magnets like jobs and, yeah.
Exactly. But I think, look, I don't have the resources to arrest 11 million people, so that's why we prioritize what we do. But it takes a lot of things. Like right now, we're talking about negotiations on DACA, and I've been very clear the last couple of weeks from my perspective. You can't have a clean DACA bill. You need to, if you're going to talk about DACA, you need to talk about the underlying reasons people come to the United States. So we need to talk about changes in policies and changes in laws and the loopholes in the system that people take advantage of, and look at the magnets that bring people here. This year, under this president, we've had a 45-year low of illegal immigration coming across the southwest border. And that's not a coincidence. That's because we're enforcing laws as they're written. If we don't talk about the reason for illegal immigration, in 10 years from now, we're going to be back at the table talking about the next DACA population, because I've done this for 34 years. I've seen this happen over and over again. So we made significant progress this year. We certainly have the knowledge and the ability to fix this. We just need the willpower. So I'm hoping we can have a true discussion with Congress and address some of these issues this year.
When you talk about eliminating the magnets that bring people across the border, you mentioned undocumented immigrants who have U.S. citizen children. Do you consider that to be one of the magnets?
No. Well, if you're asking me, do some illegal aliens come into this country to have a child, that child's going to be a United States citizen? That is one factor. Of course it is.
Is that something that you think is a magnet that should be gotten rid of?
You know, that's... Again, you know, I have my personal opinions on things, but as the director of ICE, I'm the head of a law enforcement agency, and my job is to enforce the laws enacted by Congress. So I'll tell you this, I'll enforce any law enacted by Congress, and I'll stop enforcing any law that Congress repeals. I mean, that's my job. I mean, I got to separate myself, and that's often something that gets ignored by a lot of people. They want to vilify the men and women of ICE, including me, for doing the jobs, you know, doing our job by enforcing laws enacted by Congress. That is our job. And people say, well, you know, you don't have a heart. Let me tell you something. Every person that works for me has a heart. I certainly feel bad for the plight of some of these people, but I got a job to do. So I'm enforcing laws. And if people don't like what we do or how we do it, then rather than protesting out in front of my building or vilifying the men, brave men and women of ICE, that
it's never ending, your bullshit.
Leave the safety and security of their home every day to put their lives online in this country. Talk to your congressman and senator. Tell them to change the law. Because, again, I only enforce the laws they enact, and I stop enforcing laws they repeal.
Thomas Homan is Acting Director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
No logic, no reason, no explanation.
You hear about Trump?
Just a prolonged nightmare.
Be careful, son. I can sue you.
Which fear, loneliness, and the unexplainable walk hand in hand through the shadows. Because this is the Twilight Zone.
Bing, bing, bong. Bing, bing, bong.
Back on page 8 of the executive calendar of the United States Senate is a long list of nominations that are pending before the Senate. And one of these, which is calendar number 629, on the message number 1402, is the name Brian Allen Benchkowski of Virginia to be an assistant attorney general. You would have to search the executive calendar to find it, but it's going to be voted on this afternoon in the Senate. Is it another routine nomination? Not at all. This is a position in the Department of Justice, an assistant attorney general, who is the leader, is responsible for over 600 federal prosecutors who are prosecuting cases across the criminal spectrum, from treason against the United States to opioid crisis, everything in between. 600 men and women, professionals, spread across the United States, prosecuting the laws, the cases on behalf of the United States government. And now President Trump has suggested that he wants this man, Brian Allen Benchkowski of Virginia, to be in charge of those 600 prosecutors. Is this a big assignment? In the Department of Justice, it is one of the biggest assignments. He will be directing the cases that are filed on behalf of the United States of America, critical cases to protect our national security, critical cases relative to crimes that are being committed, critical cases when it comes to our rights as citizens. He will be leading 600 federal prosecutors. Is it not reasonable for us to ask a basic question about Brian Allen Benchkowski of Virginia? We did in the Judiciary Committee. And here's the question we asked. Mr. Benchkowski, you are seeking the position of Assistant Attorney General in charge of the criminal division with 600 prosecutors that you will direct. Please tell the committee how many cases you have prosecuted as a lawyer. First, civil cases. The answer? None. Oh, well, how about criminal cases? How many criminal cases have you prosecuted in your lifetime as a lawyer? None. How many motions have you filed before a federal court? None. Wait a minute. You are being chosen to head up the criminal division of the Department of Justice, and you have no experience. You have never prosecuted a case, never, never once been in a federal courtroom, not one time. That's a fact. You know, so far, President Trump has sent us a record number of nominees for the federal courts. And I will tell you, as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, all but two have been approved. I think some of them are awful choices. And some are good. But the awful choices are men and women who have said and done things in their legal practice and private lives which really raise serious questions about whether they have the temperament to be a federal judge. Without exception, except for two cases. Without exception, all of the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee have voted every time for Trump nominees. The two exceptions were a district court judge from Louisiana and a district court judge from Alabama. And in both of those cases, people who were being appointed by the Trump administration to a lifetime appointment in a federal district court had no experience in a federal courtroom. I can tell you that one of the hearings on one of the Trump nominees, and I won't bring his name up for the record, but you can find it if you wish, cross-examination by a Republican senator on our committee, Senator Kennedy of Louisiana, was devastating. This Trump nominee couldn't find his way to a federal courthouse with GPS. He had no experience whatsoever in trying a case. And so the decision was made to withdraw his nomination. Only twice in a year and a half have Trump nominees been so unqualified that they've withdrawn their nominations. And now, this afternoon, we consider Brian, Alan Benchkowski of Virginia to head up the criminal division of the U.S. Department of Justice, a man with no experience, none, in a federal courtroom, not in a civil case, not in a criminal case. But there's more to the story. Why is he here? He's here because at one point in his career, he was chief of staff to then Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama. Worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee. I remember seeing him. He looked like a competent, affable Senate staffer. We didn't have any direct relationship. But now that Sessions, Senator Sessions, has been elevated to Attorney General, he wants this chief of staff, Brian Alan Benchkowski, to head up one of the most important divisions in the Department of Justice. That's his connection. That's his angel. That's why his name's on his calendar. That's why the Trump administration chose him. If that were the end of the story, it would be bad enough. Someone with no experience whatsoever prosecuting a case to head up 600 federal prosecutors. But as they say, and Paul Harvey used to say, there's more to the story. You see, what happened was this. Follow me, if you will. After Donald Trump won the presidency and was in his transition period, Mr. Benchkowski left his private practice of law to be part of the Trump Transition Committee assigned to the Department of Justice. And between November and January, the swearing-in, he served on that transition committee, trying to smooth the way for the new administration to take over the Department of Justice. At the end, when the president was sworn in, President Trump was sworn in, Mr. Benchkowski left the transition committee and went back to his private practice here in Washington for a well-known firm. But before he returned to that firm, he sent a letter to the president saying, I hope that you'll consider me to appoint me as a U.S. attorney somewhere in the United States. Remember, he has no experience, none. Never prosecuted a case, but he suggested he wanted to be considered for that lower level position compared to the head of the division as he returned to private practice. He went back to his law firm, followed the story. He goes back to this law firm, and one of the partners at the law firm calls him in and says, I need for you to take over a case to represent one of our firm's clients. The client is known as Alpha Bank. Alpha Bank. It is a Russian bank. And it's a Russian bank, as I described the story, is very significant in terms of our conversation today about the Russian impact on the U.S. government. Alpha Bank needed Mr. Benchkowski to look at the so-called Steele dossier. Do you remember that? The memo that came out about then-candidate Trump and things that were alleged that occurred in Russia? Well, they asked Mr. Benchkowski, represent the Alpha Bank because their name popped up in the Steele dossier, and we think it's terrible, and they want to consider a defamation lawsuit. So Mr. Benchkowski takes on the Alpha Bank as a client in reference to allegations made in the Steele dossier. There's more to the story. During the course of the Trump campaign, there were unexplained pings and contacts between Alpha Bank and the Trump campaign computers. More than one. still unexplained, as to why this Russian bank would have any access or communication with the computers of the Trump campaign. You see, the Alpha Bank is not just another corner bank. The Alpha Bank is run by individuals who are oligarchs in Russia. They are closer to Vladimir Putin than you can imagine. When the Alpha Bank decided to open up its London office, they invited as their guest for the opening of the office Vladimir Putin, who traveled to London to be there for the opening of the office of the Alpha Bank. So this Alpha Bank is pretty well connected. And they had some communication, still unexplained, between that bank and the Trump campaign. And now Mr. Benchkowski is representing the Alpha Bank on a question of defamation lawsuits concerning the Steele dossier. Wouldn't you just think for a moment that if you were Mr. Benchkowski, considering the possibility of a job in the Trump administration, you would have said to your law firm, I'm not going to touch this one. We have all these allegations about Russian involvement in the campaign. We have some computer contact between Alpha Bank and the Trump campaign. We have this oligarch close to Vladimir Putin personally. We have this Steele dossier which mentions the Alpha Bank. Wouldn't you think that the average lawyer would say, sorry to his law firm, I'm being considered for a position in the Trump administration. I'm not going to get close to the Alpha Bank. No. Mr. Benchkowski said, I'll do the work for the Alpha Bank. Well, when the time came, and he wasn't considered for a U.S. attorney spot, he was considered to head up all the U.S. attorneys, to head up the criminal division of the Department of Justice. Mr. Benchkowski filed all of these papers about all of his activities as a Senate staffer, as a lawyer, and all the rest. He failed to disclose in the course of that he'd represented the Alpha Bank. Not good. It was discovered with some background checks through the FBI that he was in that position. So he was confronted. And basically we said in a committee, are you going to recuse yourself from any matters before the Department of Justice involving the Russian investigation? No, he said, I won't. I'm going to stick with involving myself in the Russian investigation. Well, what will you recuse yourself from in light of this representation of Alpha Bank? I won't take up any cases involving Alpha Bank. That's it? That's it. That's the best we could get from him in terms of recusing himself from any potential conflict of interest. Why is this important at this moment in time? Because at this moment in time, I don't know when Bob Mueller will complete his investigation. I don't know how the White House will react. I don't know what will happen with the Attorney General Sessions, who now has recused himself from the Russian investigation. I don't know what will happen when it comes to any threats to the Assistant Attorney General in terms of his future. But there is a possibility that if this president decides that he is going to take an action, which is going to have a direct impact on the Mueller investigation, if he decides, for example, that he is going to remove from consideration of this in future the Assistant Attorney General who appointed Bob Mueller, I'm talking about Rod Rosenstein, a vacancy in that position could be filled by Mr. Benchkowski. He could take up that position. Is this an important decision then? Back here on page 8 of the calendar, voted on this afternoon? I think it is. First, the obvious gross incompetence and inexperience of this man to head up the criminal division of the Department of Justice. Second, the fact that he represented the Alpha Bank, which is under suspicion and investigation as to its activities. Third, the close connection between Alpha Bank and its owners with Vladimir Putin in Russia. Fourth, the ongoing investigation of the Russian involvement in our last election campaign. Fifth, the threat that this could occur again in the future. Sixth, the fact that we need an aggressive Department of Justice to stand up and protect the right of vote of every single America. The list goes on and on. This is the wrong man for this job. I cannot believe, as a proud Democratic senator, that the Republican Party couldn't find one experienced prosecutor in the United States to take over the criminal division of the Department of Justice, and instead they're going to give it to a man who has never ever darkened the door of a federal courthouse? That's what they're doing. It shows you the links they're going to go to. And it shows you the importance of just another nomination stuck on page 8 on the calendar that'll be voted on this afternoon. And here's the question. It's a majority vote. There are 50 Republican senators and 49 Democrats in this chamber. Senator McCain, of course, is ill and hasn't been here for several months. 50 to 49 of those likely to attend today. Under the rules as written in the Senate, a majority vote could move this man forward, Mr. Benchkowski. That's all it takes. What it boils down to is whether or not any Republican senators see a problem with this nomination. I hope that each one of those senators will reflect on the fact that they personally know a handful of individuals, maybe more, who are more qualified to take on this critical job than Mr. Benchkowski. Please join us in stopping this nomination. Let's put somebody on this job that understands it, has experience. How many people would walk into a lawyer's office and say, I'd like you to represent me. Have you ever had a case like mine before? And the lawyers say, nope, never seen one like this, never represented anybody like you. And the client would reply, perfect. That's just what I'm looking for. Someone who is so inexperienced and so incapable of representing me, I can't wait to pay you your fee. Let's not pay the fee to Mr. Benchkowski. Let's return him to his private practice. Mr. President, I yield the floor and suggest the absence of a quorum.
Savino Veritas.
Total fabrication.
The gripes of wrath.
As the FBI investigation into Russian interference started up, it was just starting up in the summer of 2016, and Peter Strzok was working on that investigation. He exchanged texts with Lisa Page at the FBI, apparently while the two of them were each watching TV footage of the Republican National Convention. Now, I'm going to read you one of those texts from Peter Strzok. I'm not going to swear when I read that text, but I want you to know that I'm going to make an obvious allusion to a swear word, just in case you're watching with your kid and you don't want your kid to hear it. Ready? All right, one, two, three. Quote, F the cheating mother effing Russians. Bastards. I hate them. I think they're the worst. Effing conniving, cheating savages at statecraft, athletics, you name it. I'm glad I am on Team USA. Ah, yes, Peter Strzok's damning text messages. President Trump and the Republicans who support him in Congress have decided that Peter Strzok's personal texts make him rightfully an object of outrage and apoplectic distraction on the right. Some of his personal texts, which have been made public, are in fact very critical of then-presidential candidate Donald Trump. His texts are also critical and profane and snarky toward Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and Loretta Lynch and Eric Holder and lots of other people besides, not to mention his swearing tirades against the cheating mother-effing Russians. The only active political figure he expresses any positive feelings about appears to be John Kasich. Okay.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
But we are today probably the most uneducated, underread, and illiterate nation in the Western Hemisphere, which makes it all the more puzzling to me why the biggest question on your small mind is whether or not little Johnny is going to recite the Pledge of Allegiance every morning. I'll tell you something else, Mr. Brickhead. I have had it up to here with you and your phony issues and your Yankee Doodle yakking. If you like reciting the Pledge of Allegiance every day, then I think you should do it in the car, in the shower, wherever the mood strikes you. But don't try to tell me when or where I have to say or do or salute anything, because I am an American too. And that is what being an American is all about. And another thing, I am sick and tired of being made to feel that if I am not a member of a little family with 2.4 children who goes just to Jerry Falwell's church and puts their hands over their hearts every morning, that I am unreligious, unpatriotic, and un-American, because I have news for you, Mr. Brickhead. All liberals are not kooks any more than all conservatives are fascists. And the last time I checked, God was neither a Democrat nor a Republican. And just for your information, yes, I am a liberal, but I am also a Christian. And I get down on my knees and pray every day on my own turf, on my own time. One of the things that I pray for, Mr. Burkett, is that people with power will get good sense. And people with good sense will get power. And that the rest of us will be blessed with the patience and the strength to survive the people like you in the meantime.
Hobie didn't know what Trump's pitch was going to be. He was sure of one thing. It was going to cost the people of Talpa.
Be careful, son. I can sue you.
Fascism.
A governmental system led by a dictator having complete power.
Bing, bing, bong.
Forcibly suppressing opposition and criticism, regimenting all industry, commerce, etc., and emphasizing an aggressive nationalism and often racism.
You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
Secretary Clinton, does Mr. Trump have the discipline to be a good leader?
No.
Oh, I'm shocked to hear that.
When you first walk in this office every day, and you think of it.
It's great. Just take a look, at my desk. Papers.
You are getting the presidential daily brief.
Yes.
Only once a week.
Just launched 59 missiles heading to Iraq.
Headed to Syria.
Yes. And what I said is what I mean. So hopefully they'll understand, Peter, exactly what I said and the meaning of those words. Those words are very, very easy to understand. They sacrifice every day for the furniture and future.
Do I look like a president? How handsome am I, right? How handsome?
I will tell you this, Russia, if you're listening. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thinking about doing a Trump Tower, Moscow.
I spoke indirectly and directly to President Putin, who could not have been nicer.
I don't think I've ever met him. I mean, if he's in the same room or something, but I don't think so.
Never spoken to him on the phone?
I never met him in Moscow. Where?
We will make America strong again, make America safe again, make America proud again, make America great again.
It's fired!
Tough guy, Mr. Tough guy.
Quiet, quiet, quiet! Don't be rude!
We'll destroy his career.
Obviously, I'm being sarcastic.
Fire and fury.
But not that sarcastic, to be honest with you.
The world has never seen.
This is an island sitting in the middle of an ocean. And it's a big ocean.
Repeal and replace Obamacare.
I don't care how sick you are.
I went to the best school, got the best great marks, everything else. Every day, every morning, same words.
At real Donald Trump.
I tweet, he's the founder of ISIS.
Hatred, bigotry.
I'm not finished, fake news.
And violence on many sides.
The president of the United States.
Make America great again, and it's gonna be greater than ever before. We have a chance to be greater than ever before. Greater than ever before.
Stop it!
Hi, fellow white people. Are you having a sad because that family is enjoying a picnic in the park while being black? Did that customer in front of you just speak a language that makes you irrationally angry? Well, this is a great time to try. Mind your own f***ing business. With Mind Your Own F***ing Business, you'll be able to grow the f*** up and act like a decent f***ing human being. Our patented technology allows you to pull your head out of your ass and see the world beyond the brim of your MAGA hat.
Hi, honey. I saw some black people at the Starbucks today.
Did you mind your own f***ing business?
I sure f***ing did.
Stop bothering those nice people today with Mind Your Own F***ing Business.
Side effects may include not harassing people, no one getting arrested or murdered by police, a general sense of well-being for people of color, a lack of internet fame and or trolling and coexistence. Please consult your doctor if you are still a piece of f*** after minding your own f***ing business, as the symptoms may be a result of a deeper problem and require further treatment.
Now available at Anthropology and Whole Foods.
Hello, I'm Adolf Hitler. Remember this? Those were the days of World War II. My war, and probably your war too. War-torn Dresden, Berlin when it was won, Alsace-Lorraine, and who could forget the Warsaw ghettos? Now you can preserve all these wonderful memories with the songs that captured entire continents. Now the people at Stalag House have put together a collection of the most beloved songs of the master race. This two-album set contains such great oldies as Spy on Your Mother for the Fatherland, Heil Heil, the Gang's All Here, and my personal favorite, Deutschland über Alles. This was one of Eva's favorites. There's Goebbels with his first big hit, Gering My Way. You'll get the original recording of the dance furore of the times, the Goose Step.
You will do the Goose Step.
All these recordings were commissioned personally by me and were recorded at SS Sound Studios. There's Rommel and the Panzers, Thanks a Lot. How are things with Mussolini? Russian to the Front. Gestapo in the Name of Love by the Supremacists, and many, many more. The price is only $19.32 for records and $19.45 for tapes. And if you act now, you'll get Poland. So remember, today the album, tomorrow, who knows? Here's how to order.
To get your Adolf Hitler album, send to Tomorrow the World, care of Martin Bormann, Argentina.
Well, that was a phony commercial. We were just kidding around. And now, here's a real dead air break.
Sabino Veritas listeners, that last bit, the Master Race record offer, was from the 1970s comedy radio show Dead Air, which can be heard at JuicedTalk.com, JuicedTalk.com, as this show can be heard on JuicedTalk.com. Tune in again next Thursday, live at 148.ca/1, or hear all archived episodes of Dead Air and this, Savino Veritas, at JuicedTalk.com. Remember, I may be joking, but I'm never kidding.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.